You're listening to WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Arlene McMichael. The Watergate scandal started to unfold 45 years ago this summer. Coming up, Gordon Evans interviews Tom Vance about his book published in 2000 about Elliot Richardson, the attorney general who refused to fire a special prosecutor. But first, I talk with the new CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Kalamazoo. Chris Harris-Wimsett took over from Robert Ezell, who retired after 30 years heading the agency. Most recently, the Raleigh, North Carolina native and former Stryker executive was director of Western Michigan University Cedar Scholars Program that helps former foster kids make a successful transition to college. Harris-Wimsett had a tough childhood himself and says he found a safe place in his local boys' club as a youth. Welcome to WMUK.
Thanks for having me here, Arlene.
Let's talk about that connection to the Boys and Girls Club.
So I was born in Raleigh, North Carolina, and I joined my club the first day after my sixth birthday. So July 5th of 1972. I had wanted to join the year before, but I had to be 6 years old in order to join. And that was my birthday gift from my mom. It was $5 to join the club. That happens to also be the same year that Bob Ezell started working at the Boys and Girls Club here in Kalamazoo at our Lake Street unit. So it's just a coincidence component from that standpoint. But for me, the Boys and Girls Club, it was a place that not only saved my life, but it gave me life. And to give you a little more background on that, so my mom and biological dad separated when I was very young. I wouldn't know my dad if he walked through the door. I've seen him once since I was 6 years old and probably can only recall seeing him twice in my life. My mom was an alcoholic. She's a recovering alcoholic now, but my mom would leave me alone for weeks at a time. So as a 5, 6, 7 year old, I was walking the streets by myself. We lived in, at times, rooming houses where you would rent a room out of a house, and we didn't have a bathroom that we could use. So we'd have a bucket that I'd use a restroom in and another bucket that I would bathe in. And, you know, I'd have one pair of underwear that I would take off once a week and wash those once a week. I walked to my club. My club was about a mile and a half from my home. As a six-year-old, I'd walk there after school and walk home at 8 o'clock at night. And it was just a place. My club never knew a lot of these things that happened. But what they did know is that when I walked through the door, that I was a young man that they could have an opportunity to make an impact on. And they made a huge impact for me. One, they were the ones who followed up with my school to make sure that I was doing well in school. If I didn't go to school that day, our club had a policy that I could not be at the club, and I wanted to be at the club because it was a safe place for me. It was a place that I felt that I belong. I felt connected. The staff one in particular, his name is Ron Williams. He served as not only a staff member, but as a friend, as a brother, you know, as a father. He was everything in so many different ways. And that's what the club really represented. They gave me leadership opportunities. They took me on travel trips with sporting teams or gave me opportunities to just get engaged and learn how to be a leader, how to give back. We did a lot of community things. So we'd go work with rest homes and things of that nature. They were there. I played in over 2,000 sporting events between 6 years old and graduating high school, and my club attended most of those. My family, my biological family, attended less than 5 of those in that time frame. So when there was something that was significant in my life, it was the club was a part of that transition for me.
What was your major in college?
So I have an undergrad in business with a focus in finance. And then I have a master's in human resource development.
I'm listening to you talking about your major being business and finance, yet there's this other kind of human services, social services aspect to you. There was kind of always this like dual tension going on in your life. At the time that you were in college, what did you imagine your career to be?
My first desire was to be a high school counselor or work on a college campus. I wanted to work with, you know, 18 to 25 is really where the heart of my passion comes in. I just didn't at the time feel that I could do that and support my family and myself. So I said, I'll go and I'll do the military. My plan was to retire after 20 years in the military, and then I could go and work as a, on a college campus or in as a high school counselor and not really focus on how much I'm making, but what the impact I'm being able to have. And that was the initial plan.
Somewhere along the way, you get yourself here to Kalamazoo. You begin to work at Stryker. Then the position opens up at Cedar Scholars at Western Michigan University. That's a program at Western Michigan University that helps former foster children transition into the college environment. How many years were you at Cedar Scholars?
I was the director of the Cedar Scholars program for 5 years.
Okay. Chris Harris-Wimsett has been president, vice president, and secretary on the board of Kalamazoo's Boys and Girls Club. He says he declined the invitation to apply for the CEO position of the club, wanting to continue his work at the Cedar Scholars Program. But when the field of 118 candidates was narrowed down to a single finalist, he was asked again if he wished to apply. That's when he says after much prayer, he said yes.
To give back to an organization that has given so much and continues to give so much to me and to my family, to be able to come back and to have an impact on the legacy of this going forward and to impact other young people such as myself, that is like having the biggest piece of chocolate cake and just being able to eat it. It's a win-win-win all around.
What are some of your goals at the Boys and Girls Club?
So one of the things that we are doing is figuring out what our strategic plan is. So the good piece is that our strategic plan ended in 2016, and the board and I are in the process of cultivating one that takes us not just through a three-year time frame, but we're looking through the 2024-25 fiscal year. And we are in the process of doing that, but there are a couple things that we're looking at. One is we want to strengthen the organization, and what that means is it's financial sustainability. It is leveraging our community partners. We're not trying to duplicate what's out there. We're trying to say, what's out there? How do we leverage it? When you look at the cycle of our youth, and so that means how our youth transition into our club, what value are we adding to them while they're at the club, and then how do we transition them out into the next phase of what they are going to be or who they're going to be? We need to look at all of those pieces, and then who do we have as partners that do this well? And how do we bring us together in order to have the most healthy impact? So we want to leverage that with our community resources. We want to enhance our staff retention and development. So in the nonprofit world, especially here, you're looking, it's not about pay. People do this because they have a joy and passion, but we still need to look at how do we do a respectable pay and how do we develop our employees and grow them and move things forward. We want to also look at how do we advocate for youth development, and then how do we reach more youth. We have a teen center in our club, but we don't have space big enough to impact all of the youth that want to be able to come. So as much as we're able to do, there's still more that is needed. When we look in our community, we have a very large Latino community. And right now, we're not able to impact them in the way that we would like to. So we want to build and strengthen that relationship and be able to reach those young people to help them develop. We have a very large refugee community that's in the area. Our club is in the three most underrepresented places in Kalamazoo. And so we want to make sure that we're impacting the young people that are there, and it in turn impacts their family. And how do we move that forward? And then we want to improve program quality. So we're always looking at every opportunity of engagement with the youth is a chance for an educational development moment. And so how do we do that, and how do we bridge that?
I can't recall if you mentioned that one of your goals is infrastructure. Did you mention that?
So infrastructure is a big piece of our goal.
Are you thinking building elsewhere, building an additional facility, or just doing the one that you have? Because you talked about not having enough teen space.
You know, it's looking at all of those different options. But the piece that we need to look at is what I try to explain to people. It's you see this old house that you want to buy and purchase, and it has great bones. And we just need to go in and spruce it up some, but not just get it to 2017, but we need to get it to where we're going in the future and getting it to the 2024-25 realm. So we have some infrastructure components that we're looking at, whether it's security of the building, whether it's how many youth do we need to serve and do we have the capacity to serve them in the facilities that we do, what things are happening in the facilities and how we do that based on the objectives that we're trying to, based on the impact that we're trying to have. We have a camp area that is in Hastings, Michigan. It has 200, it's 200 acres. And so out there, what can we do to enhance the youth experience and how does that go into developing those life skills and adding value to who they are as individuals? But when we're not using that, how do we leverage that facility to become self-sustaining from a revenue generation component or to be able to add revenue back into the organization by supporting other programs that are impacting people? So we're just looking at that big picture and seeing what can we do, how do we do it, and then how do we do it with the partnerships that we have.
I can't recall if you mentioned this, but I thought also that a priority that you have too is incorporating kind of more of a youth voice in the programming.
Youth voice is a critical component. I think it's very difficult for us. When I say us, I mean me, the staff, our board, our community, to talk or support something that we are no longer a part of. Now, I have been a youth. We all have been a youth. I have been a youth in the Boys and Girls Club. But the things that I went through as a young person, I was molested by 13 different people, some on multiple occasions. During my time between 6 and 16 years of age, my club didn't know that. But they were there to support me and give me a safe place to go. When you spend that time with a young person, you don't have to know exactly what they're going through. But when you spend that time and you give them hope and you just show them that you care, that is huge. And you learn a lot of different things. This past year when we did our annual meeting, one of our board members presented on the plight of the young people that come into our club. And she had done, Marcy, she had done a some research on this piece with some young people. And she said, so when you're coming and you're trying to get to, I think in that case it was to the school, what are the things that you have to go through? And they painted this, they did this drawing of all these pictures and things of that nature. And it was, you know, shooting, it was gang violence, it's the texting, the bullying, all of these different components. It's the way that those things are done. It's so much more intense these days. And she's like, where is the positivity that is here? And it was in these little spots. And so it's more difficult for them to be able to see that light at the end of the tunnel. We need to be able to understand what those young people are going through and how they're experiencing it today, because the way that they're receiving that, even though it's a similar component, is very different than how I was able to receive that as a young person, so that we can go out and be their advocates, that we are the ones that can go and impact the policy, that we are the ones that can go and to provide the protection that they need. We are the ones that can ask the questions that they don't know. But if we don't understand what it is that they have or what it is that they're going through, then it's harder for us to be the advocates and provide them the space that's going to help them to change the paradigm from which they've come.
You've been listening to Chris Harris-Wimsett, the new CEO of the Boys and Girls Club of Greater Kalamazoo. He invites the community to the club's upcoming 100 Men Who Cook event on August 12th that will raise funds to aid programming. For more information and a longer version of this interview, visit WMUK.org. For West Southwest on WMUK, I'm Earlene McMichael.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. 45 years ago this summer, the nation was starting to learn about a break-in at Democratic National Committee headquarters at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. It was called a third-rate burglary, but a little more than 2 years later, Richard Nixon resigned the presidency. One of the key figures in the so-called Watergate scandal was Elliot Richardson. Tom Vance now works for the Kalamazoo Community Foundation. He first met Elliot Richardson as a student journalist from Western Michigan University in 1976. Vance is the author of Elliot Richardson, The Virtue of Politics. It was originally published in 2000. Thank you for being here, Tom.
Thanks for having me, Gordon.
So first of all, let's go back and talk about how you developed such an interest. And I think if someone reads this book, it's fair to say an admiration for Elliot Richardson.
Right. A clear admiration. And I try to be objective. But I'm certainly a fan of his public service. So when I was at Western, All the President's Men came out in 76 when I was on the Western Herald. And all of us saw that movie many times. And Elliot Richardson was not a central figure in the movie, but it was clear that he was one of the heroes of a very traumatic political event. So he was in Benton Harbor that fall campaigning for Republican candidates. And Conrad Sutter, who was also on the Western Herald with me, we went and covered Elliot Richardson, and we met him. And I had just bought his book, and I was too chicken to take his book in to have Richardson sign it. But fortunately, Conrad had brought it in from the car without me knowing it. And he went up to Richardson and said, "Would you sign this for my friend?" So I had his copy of The Creative Balance, which was published in 76 when Richardson was the Commerce Secretary. And that sort of became my little repository of Elliot Richardson information over the years. So fast forward to in the early 1980s when my wife and I were in Germany when I was in the Army, I reread The Creative Balance and I wrote Richardson a letter. I don't know if he ever got it, but I sent it to him through the publisher. And I told him how much I admired his career. And I said, "I'm waiting for someone to write a biography of you. And if that doesn't happen, I'll have to do it myself," which was a pretty bold thing for a lieutenant in Germany that's just, you know, early in his career. So then fast forward to I'm in a graduate writing class here at Western. Brad Hayden, an amazing writer that was busy here at Western teaching people how to write even better. We were in this class, and he asked everybody what you would do if you didn't have to work for a living, like, you know, if you won the lottery and you could do anything you wanted to. And I said I'd like to write a biography of Elliot Richardson. And I guess my enthusiasm came through so much that Professor Hayden and everyone in the class said, like, "Oh, Tom, you need to do that somehow. You need to figure out a way to write a biography of Richardson." And, of course, I was working full-time at the Upjohn Company then, and I didn't have the time it took to do real serious research like the Library of Congress and everything. So I decided to write a book for children, you know, for young adults.
Yeah.
And I figured I could do that, and it could serve as an example of the next generation for politics. So I started doing that, and I got to meet Richardson the next summer in Washington and had an hour-long interview with him. And this goes a long way of saying what kind of person he was. I submitted 20 questions ahead of time. And when we sat down, he said, "Okay, you've got 20 questions here. Which three do you want to talk about?" And we had an hour. So I panicked and had to pick the three most central questions. And each one was answered by a 15-minute long answer. So I kept working on it. And by 2000, I had a 35,000-word biography that the Council for Excellence in Government accepted and they put online. And Richardson saw a draft of it in December, and he died the New Year's Eve 1999.
So when he became Attorney General, was it largely seen as somebody who had a very sterling reputation in Washington and someone who people trusted?
He did. And he was, when Nixon was brand new president, Richardson became his Deputy Secretary of State, the number two person at the State Department. And he did that, and then he was elevated to the head of health, education, and welfare, his first real cabinet position. And then when Nixon reorganized his administration, he wanted Richardson as the defense secretary. And Richardson didn't really want that. It's interesting, with Richardson's background, he was never very ambitious. He wanted to do great things, but he wasn't willing to do things necessary to do the great things. He just wanted to be tapped for his knowledge. He just wanted to serve. So he was happy.
When you say do the things necessary, you're sort of the political behind the scenes things of,
right.
to power plays and that sort of thing. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah. When he clerked for Justice Felix Frankfurter, Frankfurter gave him some career advice that he always adhered to. And that was enjoy the job you're doing at the time for the sake of that job. And if you're always looking to position yourself for the next couple jobs in the future, then you're not really enjoying or focusing on your current job. And Richardson took that to heart. So he didn't really want to become Secretary of Defense. He was happy at HEW, but he went ahead and took that position. And then after 3 months as Secretary of Defense, President Nixon wanted him to become Attorney General. Watergate was starting to percolate at that point, and Richardson actually said no several times. And finally, Nixon insisted, and Richardson said, well, I have to serve the president. He was very loyal, and he was a loyal team player. So the only way he took the job as Attorney General, he sat down with the president, and he had to make sure the president was innocent of any wrongdoing. And President Nixon assured Richardson that he had known nothing about Watergate. And he said, you pursue this wherever it goes, protect the presidency, don't protect the president or the administration. So Richardson was convinced that Nixon was innocent, and he took the job. And this is something that doesn't come through in a lot of the Watergate coverage that your listeners are hearing now. Watergate wasn't going to be the biggest problem at this point. He was brand new attorney general, and then he learns early into his job, the U.S. attorney from Maryland contacts him and says, we've got a problem with the vice president, Spiro Agnew.
Who had been governor of Maryland.
Had been governor of Maryland, and the U.S. attorney for Maryland had discovered that as governor of Maryland, Spiro Agnew was possibly involved with kickbacks, bribes, and tax evasion. And then they found out that it actually continued when he became vice president. And as things developed over the summer of 1973, when it became obvious that President Nixon probably would not survive as president, Richardson had to get Agnew to resign so he could be replaced by a new vice president so there'd be someone in charge when Nixon might be forced out of office. This was Richardson's summer of 1973.
How did Elliot Richardson come to know Archibald Cox? And people who are deep into the Watergate history know that those two names will always be synonymous and linked together, but linked to the Watergate story.
Right. Archie Cox was Richardson's law professor at Harvard. They hadn't been friends, but he'd never really lost track of Archibald Cox. And actually, Archie Cox had given Richardson some career advice also when Richardson was climbing up the ladder. And actually, as you can imagine, there weren't a long list of people who wanted to become special prosecutor. Richardson had a hard time finding reputable people who would do that, so Archie Cox was not his first choice. But he was a good choice, and he'd been Solicitor General. He was a Democrat, and that's something that President Nixon didn't really approve of the selection of Archie Cox. But throughout the summer, Richardson and Cox worked together. Cox would be trying to investigate the Watergate crisis. The White House would constantly push back. Richardson would get calls from Alexander Haig, who was Nixon's chief of staff, or from Nixon himself, and say, tell Cox to back off. And when Richardson went in front of his Senate confirmation hearings to be Attorney General, the Senate made Richardson promise that he would appoint a special prosecutor and that only Richardson could fire the special prosecutor, and that could only be for extraordinary improprieties. And so Richardson had that commitment to the Senate. So as the summer progressed, it became obvious that Richardson was probably not going to survive in his job if he was going to honor his promise to the Senate. And finally, things came to a head on October 20th where the president wanted Cox fired, and Richardson met with him several times with the president and with Cox. He just wasn't able to fix it, and so he resigned. And then the president ordered William Ruckelshaus, who was the number two at Justice, the deputy attorney general. Ruckelshaus resigned too. And then it fell to Robert Bork, who was the number three person at the Justice Department.
And this is what is known as the Saturday Night Massacre.
Right.
When we had three attorneys general in the United States on the same day, two people refusing to fire the special prosecutor. Is it fair to say that that is one of the major turning points in Watergate, where we move from the idea of a third-rate burglary to this is obstruction of justice, these are the sort of things that merit impeachment and the discussion of impeachment in Congress of a sitting president?
It really did turn the tide with the public. When Elliott resigned, 3 million telegrams, this was back when people sent telegrams before people could tweet or send emails. 3 million telegrams were sent to Washington, D.C. in support of Richardson and Ruckelshaus and in support of Archie Cox. So I think it was, and even Republican leaders then, Richardson had so much credibility. He didn't like labels, but he considered himself a moderate. But he was seen as a key figure in the liberal wing of the Republican Party, which you don't even hear about anymore, which is an oxymoron now, right? Or it's a paradox. But so he had so much credibility that by him resigning, that was the firestorm that started the whole series of, it was apparent that the House was going to vote for impeachment and that the Senate would go along with the impeachment. And so Nixon resigned.
So let's now draw some parallels cautiously between Elliot Richardson and the Watergate investigation in present day. And I say cautiously because it is dangerous to start talking about things that could result in the removal of the president from office when at this point there is simply an investigation and charges have not been leveled. But there are a couple of interesting things to note here. One of them, of course, being that the FBI director was fired by President Trump. And that at least some people in the Trump administration have floated the idea that special counsel Robert Mueller, who has been on the job a relatively short period of time, could be removed. When you see that and you think of Elliot Richardson, what comes to your mind?
Well, there are a lot of perils too,
maybe,
actually.
Yeah.
The Nixon White House was exhibiting a lot of paranoia. And the Nixon White House thought it was us and them. And when Richardson first joined the Nixon administration, in his first conversation with President Nixon, he said, "You've won by a huge margin, and there is no they. Everybody in the country, even people who voted against you, want you to succeed." And Nixon never really understood that. And there could be some parallels with the current administration that feels it's under siege. The press, Nixon was always attacking the press, as did Vice President Agnew. And, of course, we know the press were the good guys with Watergate, with Woodward and Bernstein and the greatest American reporting ever. There was something, though, that Richardson said after Watergate when he would talk about it. And again, your listeners need to know, he never badmouthed President Nixon. He never spoke ill of him at all. And Richardson said, you know, the system worked. For as traumatic as Watergate was to the American public, the system worked. And it wasn't pleasant, but it worked. The three branches of government, the balances of power, in the end, they all worked. And the only thing I can say to speculate for this current situation is I think our system is built to handle whatever we throw at it. And hopefully our balance of power will make everything settle.
Tom Vance's book, Elliot Richardson, The Virtue of Politics, was originally published in 2000. Thank you very much for your time.
Thanks, Gordon.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.